Plato, Part 2. The ninth talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 9, 2013, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handout mentioned in this talk is handout number 4 in this series.
Dive right in where we left off. I'll back up and review as much as you want to. Just as a reminder, we started with ancient polytheism. Then we moved from there and looked at pre-Socratic philosophy. Then we looked at Socrates. And now we're in the middle of, or started, Plato. Plato was a student of Socrates. We talked about that. And then we talked about philosophical prejudices and how important it is, I think, to understand what the nature of a philosophical prejudice, and then also to understand what the Greek philosophical prejudices were that were a part of Plato's worldview. Plato's very hard to follow and hard to understand, I think. Not hard to follow, hard to find credible, plausible, if you don't allow him his prejudices. And the big one is what I call the Greek dichotomy, and that was a list of two. Oh, by the way, and those of you online, there should be a, I think it's there for you to download. So in the middle of the first page on your notes, you have the Greek dichotomy, two columns with a set of attributes that are all connected with each other in the way that they conceive of this dichotomy. And then another set that are all connected with each other, and they each column is the antithesis of the other. So spiritual goes with immaterial, obviously, goes with good, beautiful, perfect, real, unchangeable, one, simple, rational, eternal, immortal, universal, infinite. So in Plato's dialogues, Socrates will make arguments where he will move from one of these attributes to the other. He'll say something like, well, something is beautiful, is it not? Yes, Socrates, most certainly, O Socrates. Well, if it's beautiful, then it must be real. Yes, Socrates, of course. How could it not be? And if it's real, it must be unchangeable. Oh, certainly, Socrates. I mean, I'm making that up, but that's the kind of logic that he'll use. And the reason he is so effortlessly and readily going from one of those attributes to the other is, I think, because this is a fixed philosophical prejudice within the Greek culture of his time. I don't think this is unique to Plato. Maybe it is. But I think it must be a fixed prejudice within that culture. And Plato is just reflecting that back in his writings. Now, and the thing that's most important, most striking about that, is the way that has crept into Christianity very early on. So what I argued last time is that really what we think of as Christianity was a combination, a syncretism between biblical faith, biblical ideas, biblical concepts, which are coming out of a Jewish worldview, along with certain Greek ideas, this philosophical prejudice in particular. They get bound together, and we end up with a whole new religion, basically. So that's the sense in which Christianity is really a kind of a new religion that departs from its biblical roots in the Jewish worldview. It's broken its ties with Judaism. It has shaped itself to be more accessible and palatable to the Greek Hellenistic mindset. And what comes out in the wash is what we think of as Christianity. So what I think is helpful, one of the reasons I think it's sort of helpful if Christians read a lot of Plato, is they get kind of a sense, a feel for this sort of Greek dichotomy here. And so you can kind of be alert to it and see it when it creeps into into Christianity. Because my contention is, right down to the 21st century, still in Christian culture, you still see and hear the echoes of this having an impact, this Greek dichotomy having an impact on Christianity.
Do you have an example? I thought you were maybe a little late.
Well, most of it takes place in theology and is not all that relevant. But one that's more practical is Plato, having borrowed it from Pythagoreanism, the physical is evil. The physical is unreal or less real and basically evil. The spiritual, the immaterial, is what is good. Well, it doesn't take too much to recognize that the physical has to do with marriage, sexuality, even money to some extent, that those things are all wrapped up in our physical existence. Well, our physical existence is tainted. It's corrupt. It's evil. It's not what we should be all about. So if we really want to be spiritual, then we will be ascetics. We will renounce the physical, the material, the sexual, anything that has to do with our physicality. We must move away from that in order to be spiritual. Well, there are a lot of Christian traditions where that's very much alive and well within the Christian tradition. So in the Roman Catholic Church, vows of celibacy among the clergy. And why the clergy? Well, because they're supposed to be extraordinarily spiritual. I mean, it's okay if you lay people want to be married because you're not spiritual. But for anyone who wants to be truly spiritual, they have to renounce sexuality in that case because it's tainted, it's corrupt, it's evil. Well, you don't find significant support for that in the Bible. That's not the biblical perspective. It's certainly not the Jewish worldview. So where is that coming from? Well, I think it's coming from Pythagoreanism by way of Plato. It's coming through Plato into the church. And that's one that's more practical. The others have to do with the arguments that people make about God in theology, and they don't necessarily translate into practical terms particularly. At least off the top of my head, I can't think of any. Okay, so that's where we got to. And do you want to pursue anything by way of review before we press on? Good question. We just finished page one, basically.
Okay, we're starting on part B or...
C.
Oh, C of part A.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sorry. Where are we? Yeah, small c on page two. Okay, so pressing on. I'll just call it Plato. Maybe it's a larger Greek concept, but I'll call it Plato. Plato's concept of real or reality. This was one of the most confusing things in trying to come to terms with Platonic thought, and then, for that matter, medieval thought as well, because this keeps having an impact on the history of ideas for a long time. When someone like Plato talks about something being real, they don't mean what you and I mean. What you and I mean, we tend to mean. We don't really have a clear concept of real. We kind of fake it, go through life and fake it. But what we tend to mean is something is real when it's tangible and concrete, when it's made of stuff. So this table is real. That's an obvious one for us. If you were to ask me, well, is justice real? I'm gonna hesitate, right? I don't want to say no, because I'm not going to say that there is no such thing as justice, but it's not like a table. You know, you can kick a table, you can't kick justice. So how can I call it real? Because our mind automatically goes to the material, concrete nature of something. And what makes something real is how concrete and material it is. That's where we tend to go. That's not at all where Plato is going, because Plato actually has the opposite assessment. Justice for him is a no-brainer. Justice is as real as you can get. That's really real. People, are they real? I don't know. Tables, are they real? No, well, not really. And all I have to do is say that, and you realize, what are you talking about? How can you call a table not real? Because his concept of real has to do not with how concrete it is, but ultimately how vulnerable it is to going out of existence. If something could be made to not be readily, then it's barely real. But if something could be made to not be with great difficulty or not at all, now we're talking. That's something that's real. So you can see then, justice, how are you going to get rid of justice? How are you going to get rid of love? How are you going to get rid of goodness? They're not located anywhere. You can't take a sledgehammer and a blowtorch to them and turn them into ashes. So how are you going to get rid of them? They seem to be here and here to stay. And if you get rid of one expression of them somewhere in the world, then there's going to be another expression of it somewhere else. So those abstract universal categories like that are real. They're not vulnerable to be taken out of existence. But this table, within a few minutes, I could turn this into a pile of ashes with the right instruments. It's just hanging on to its existence very tenuously, because some destroyer comes along and it isn't any longer. So for Plato, this is not really real, or not very real, or barely real, or however you want to put it. Okay, so far so good?
Yeah.
And basically, you can't get your mind around that until you just decide, when I hear that word real, it doesn't mean anything like the way I've always used that word. I mean, you just have to grant that, and then let it be redefined. Sorry, Michael.
Based on what you've said so far, would Plato's definition of real have anything to do with how entrenched in existence something is?
So, just ask that one more time.
Would Plato's definition of real have anything to do with how well entrenched something is? Yeah, but because, as you've been saying, this a table, it may be tangible, but yeah, you could easily destroy it. Yeah, so it doesn't really have anything other than its material existence to it.
Mm-hmm.
But justice, it has more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, and it's got more of a foundation than the table does. Is that Plato's reasoning, or is there something else to it?
I'm a little bit confused by the question, Michael, because I'm not sure that I know what you mean by entrenched.
Yeah, what I mean by is hard to destroy.
Yes, that's exactly what he means. Right.
Yeah, so the harder something is to destroy, the more real it is?
Right. Yeah. Or at least that's a helpful way to think about it. It may not have to do with how easy it is to destroy per se, but it's a matter of how vulnerable is that thing to not being. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That is, it the kind of thing that could not be? If it's the kind of thing that could not be, then it's not real.
Okay.
So the things that are real, notice, the things that are real are necessarily then going to be eternal. You see that?
Yes.
And if you notice the list, eternal and real were in the same column.
So Tobias has a clarifying question. So for Plato, people's bodies aren't real, but their souls are.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the body is basically not very real, but our souls are, for him, our souls are eternal. They're very real, yeah.
Well, I want to jump off something Michael said when he used the word entrenched.
Mm-hmm.
It made me think about the concept of or love. How does Plato's ideas work off something like justice or love in the entrenchment of that we might all, that many human beings would all have an idea of what justice is, even though nobody has really come up with a definition for it, but we all seem to understand what it is, or love. We all seem to understand what love is, even though none of us have been taught, really. It seems almost innate. How does that have any association to how Plato's using the idea of something that's not destructible because human beings have even knowledge of it?
Yeah.
Without being taught?
To really answer that, I need to get a little further into his theory of forms, and we'll get there, so my answer will make more sense the more we talk about him. But he believes that our souls are eternal, and this is put into the mouth of Socrates, but I think it's largely a Platonic doctrine. Did we talk about this with Socrates, the doctrine of learning as remembrance? Did we talk about that? That he tells a myth that our souls, before we came into this world in a body, our souls were hanging out in the eternal forms up in the heavens, and we saw clearly and knew everything, knew ultimate things very clearly back before we had a body. But in the process of becoming embodied, remember, material is evil, it's bad, it's heavy, it's an encumbrance, it's a prison, it does nothing but bad things. So when the soul got embodied and imprisoned in this body, it caused the soul to largely forget what it knew before. Now there's some kind of vague memory of it, but we have largely forgotten it. So when we learn things in this lifetime, what is learning? It's remembering. We're simply remembering, retrieving, getting back to that thing that our soul once knew and understood. Now, am I getting close to what
yeah.
you're...
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're okay with real. Now, the other thing is to recognize that for Plato, things exist on a continuum. Now, this is especially true. This becomes emphasized by what's called Neoplatonism. Neoplatonism is a revival of Plato's philosophy in, what, about 300, somewhere in the early centuries A.D., a man named Plotinus takes some of Plato's dialogues and becomes a teacher of those things, and that it really took off. And Neoplatonism was a very important player in the early centuries A.D. Well, in Neoplatonism especially, they emphasize that being is this continuum, that at the top, what Plotinus calls it is the one. Plato calls it the one sometimes. Plato goes in back and forth between calling it the one, the good, the beautiful. He has different names that he will give to it. But the one is brimming with being, right? I mean, the more real you are, the more being you have. The highest order of being is really, really chock full of being. When you fall away from the one, you lose being. You become diminished in the amount of being that you have. So the one is brimming with being, you get down to our level, the physical world, the physical material, material universe, and we have lost being to the point of almost being non-being. And then there's everything in between. So you have some things that are even more real than other things that are more real still, that are more real still, until you get to the most real of all, and the most real of all is the One. The most common term for God in the Middle Ages is the Ens Realissimum, or the Ens Realissimus, the most real being. It would be great. But where is that coming from? Where that's coming from is this kind of mapping Plato onto the Bible, or vice versa. Who is God? God is the One who's chock full of being, who has the most being, who's the most real, etc., etc. Well, that's straight out of Neoplatonism, not biblical Christianity. So what do you do with angels? Piece of cake, right? We all know what to do with the biblical category of an angel. Then they're somewhere more real than us and less real than God, because they're higher than us. They're higher on the hierarchy, on the continuum. They're superior beings to us. Yeah. Well, don't you think most Christians would think of angels as a superior kind of being?
Maybe, but more real, I don't see the basis.
Right.
They're still created beings.
Yeah, but see, my point is, the minute you call them more real, if you then read this continuum into it, then, I'm sorry, I don't mean more real. The minute you admit they're superior, then under this assumption, they've got to be more real. So those are the kinds of discussions that you have throughout the Middle Ages, because we're taking Platonism and using it as a kind of a philosophical framework for understanding the characters and players and actors in the Bible.
I made the comment that they have to be more real than us because they are the messengers God uses to give his information to us. And it gets fleshed out a lot, as you were saying, in the Middle Ages, when all the theologians are thinking about this and trying to synthesize it all. But the idea is the most real being can't interact with us because we're so low down on the totem pole.
That's right.
So he has to send other people to give his messages to us, and the angels are those messengers.
So they have to be real enough to interact with God, because we can't. Yeah, we're too inferior.
It actually gets to the point in the Middle Ages where, you know, God gives a message to one of the angels or beings that are right next to him, and then it goes down the line to one of the angels that can actually come and talk to us, and it kind of gets ridiculous in that respect. But yeah, basically, where it's like this person, like God told this person, who then like sent it down to his subordinate, who sent it down to their subordinate, who sent it down to their subordinate, and eventually gets to the point where they can actually go down to us and talk to us. But
blessed are the cheesemakers. Okay. All right. Well, I'm not sure where I'm going to. I think this might be coming up in my notes, but just in case I don't have it there, let me also then at this point talk about how then for Plato, he has, corresponding to this continuum, this hierarchy of being, is a hierarchy of knowledge. So some ways of knowing are superior or higher than other ways of knowing. And then the thing that's interesting is the way you know a being will correspond to where it is in the hierarchy of being. You know an inferior kind of being with an inferior kind of knowledge. And the most superior kind of being you must know with the most superior kind of knowledge. And for Plato, the most superior kind of knowledge, now especially again, this is in Neoplatonism where this gets emphasized, but is a kind of contemplation. And what makes contemplation contemplation is you don't have to go through steps to know it. You just see it. You know, you just have this direct spontaneous intellectual grasping of something. So it's kind of the best way I can think of it is when you have a hunch or an intuition where, or, you know, you've been working on a puzzle and you just, you can't get it and you stop thinking about it. And then all of a sudden you're just walking along and wham, got it. That's the answer. That's the solution to my puzzle or the solution to my problem. And where did that come from? It just came out of the blue. You didn't reason your way through it through methodical steps. You just saw. Well, what if you could just see like that everything that there is to know about everything? That would be the highest kind of knowledge. Well, that gives rise to the concept of the beatific vision in the Middle Ages. At least one, there are kind of different versions of it, but at least one version of it, a very Platonic version of it, is that the beatific vision is where you see God. And what they mean by seeing God is you see into the mind of God. So you see all as God sees all. You know all as God knows all. You know everything. But you don't know everything because you have worked it out. You know, you haven't step by step methodically reasoned your way to a certain set of conclusions. It's contemplation. You've just seen it. You've just got it. When you grasp it like that, then you have grasped it in contemplation. Well, that's the highest form of knowledge. We don't have much of that left in Protestantism. I mean, it's still, I'm sure, alive and well in Roman Catholicism. We don't have anything like the beatific vision, to my knowledge, in any Protestant tradition. But we still have a hangover of this kind of correspondence between a hierarchy of ways of knowing and a hierarchy of being in this sense. We are often told that to know God, and we might rather use the word believe in God, to believe in God, you have to have faith. Now, why faith? That's a higher form of knowing than the other ways of knowing. You know, you've got reasoning and you can know all kinds of other things just by using your mind. But when it comes to God, to really know God, you know him with faith. Now, what is faith? Well, we don't define it very well, but one thing that's pretty clear, and this corresponds to Plato, faith is certain. Faith has, you are when you have faith in something, you have absolute certainty about that thing. No doubts, no room for doubt, no hesitation, no scruples of any kind about believing it. It is a unshakable knowledge, conviction, insight that you can't be moved from. That's faith. Well, again, that's reading Plato into the pages of the New Testament. Because if you were to go to Jesus and the apostles, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. What does it mean to have faith, or what does it mean to believe? Well, you think it's true. That's what it means to believe something, is when you think something's true, you believe it. When you think something's false, you don't believe it. Well, how did you get to that? Well, I thought about it. I looked at the evidence. I looked at the arguments. I looked at the reasons for and against believing, and I became confident that something's true. And because I became confident that something's true, I believed it. And some things are important enough to stake your existence on. And those are, of course, the beliefs that are being talked about in the New Testament, are beliefs that are important enough to stake your existence on. But you don't know it with a different kind of knowledge than you know anything else. See, that's Plato, who's saying that the kind of thing it is going to determine what kind of knowledge, what way of knowing that you will know it with. Now, in the biblical worldview, there's only one way of knowing. You think about it, you look, you see, you analyze, you infer, and you figure out what you think is true and you believe it. Is there room for doubt? Well, always, sure. You could get it wrong. So, and you may have got something wrong. So you may experience doubt that's going to lead you to fix what you have wrong so that you can get it right. And that knowledge is just knowledge in the biblical worldview. There's not some kind of super knowledge, shiny knowledge, holy knowledge, spectacular knowledge that has different qualities from other kind of knowledge. You just know the way you know.
I agree with what you're saying. And so a couple things, though, that I wanted to get your reaction to. And so this would, the biblical view would be in concert with the idea of revelation. In other words, objective, propositional ideas that you can then think about. And it would not be in concert with sitting under the tree and becoming enlightened from only within your own self, sort of an epiphany. Although, what I'm leading to is, I know I have, and I know I don't put ultimate stock in my experience, because my holistic experience with mind and soul and body and emotions and everything that I am can be uncertain about what the experience is. And I might be absolutely convinced it was something, and then I sleep and then I wake up and I think, what was I thinking, you know? But I have had number of experiences, and having been working in the arts for most of my adult life, a lot of sort of epiphany type experiences where you intuitively become very conscious of things and very certain about things. And so I'm guessing there that the biblical worldview has a place for that, where you become, without conscious analysis, you still become quite convinced about something.
Right, absolutely.
And I've always thought that was a spiritual something happening in me, perhaps from God, to allow me to experience something that he was giving to me. Maybe that he gives to other people too, but in other words, it was something personal and substantial in the sense it was big enough for me to really experience, but not tangible in any way, not propositional, more of a emotional experience. And because it is vague, I'm having a hard time articulating.
I mean, you're raising a big can of worms.
All I'm saying is it seems to me that we don't all know things with relative certitude, you know, without 100% certitude. We don't only know things through conscious analysis and deliberate choice.
Absolutely.
But sometimes we just see it. We do see something.
Absolutely.
Something comes together in our head.
And in fact, I wouldn't even say sometimes. I'd say much of the time. That what we know, we don't know by kind of methodical, systematic reasoning and inference and that kind of stuff. One of the most important books I ever read, I think, was a book called Personal Knowledge by Michael Polanyi. Because what he did is he introduced to me the notion of the tacit dimension, what he calls the tacit dimension, and argues that there really are two different ways that our intelligence operates. One is at the articulate level, as I think what he calls it, articulate knowledge, and then we have tacit knowledge. The tacit knowledge is we're not conscious of it. We can't articulate it. We can't necessarily readily access it. So there's all this stuff going on where we really are knowing what we know, but I don't know what it is that I know. That is, in the sense that I can't articulate. I can't tell you what it is that I know. I just know. And I'm sure you operate in the arts with this all the time. I mean, he gives all kinds of examples of like things like connoisseurship. He gives the example of this really excellent violin maker. He goes out in the woods and he picks out some wood, saying, now this will make a good violin. Now, if you were to stop him right there and ask him, how do you know that that piece of wood will make a good violin? He's not going to really be able to tell you. He's just going to go, well, I have experience. I know because it feels and smells a certain way. I mean, he can't articulate, but it doesn't mean he doesn't know, because he keeps making good violins by picking out the wood that he's picking out. Being a connoisseur of wine. How do you become a connoisseur? You don't read Wine for Dummies and become a connoisseur. You taste it again and again and again, and you train your senses to know what they don't even know they know. Basically, any skill is like that. I mean, he gives the example of how do you learn when a heart is healthy in med school? Put a stethoscope. The doctor says, listen to this heart. There's something wrong here. And you listen. And he can't tell you what's wrong with it. You have to listen and teach yourself, oh, yeah, there's something wrong with that. And you listen and you listen and you listen until sooner or later you have developed the skill to hear what you need to hear in order to be able to judge the soundness of the heart by what it is that you're hearing. Well, every skill is like that. I can't reproduce your paintings in a paint by number. put this color right here, this color right here, this color right here. It doesn't work that way, because there's so much more to painting than just, points of paint color on a canvas. And you couldn't even tell me what it is that you know that allows you to make the paintings you make and that I could never make. You just taught yourself. You taught yourself through experience to be able to do that. So that's ubiquitous in our lives, that every skill, every connoisseurship, everything we practice, we have taught ourselves to do it, and no one could ever articulate to us what it is that you do. Now, that's not altogether true. Coaches, track coaches can sometimes say, you need to bend your elbow a little bit more, or you need to, to do this other thing. But even then, it's only an approximation of what it is I need to do. I need to learn to feel it. I need to learn to, so that my body knows what it is that I know that makes me more faster, quicker, stronger, whatever. So all that's to say, he convinced me that we've got this whole vast area of our mind that is operating underneath the radar, just constantly working, oftentimes working very, very fast. Notice that conscious thought is very slow. Well, this is true, and I think this is true, and that's probably true. And if those three things are true, then it follows that this must be, it's incredibly inefficient. Well, at some level, my mind is going through all those processes like that, just at warp speed. And that's I think, what hunches or intuitions are. I mean, the example I gave of working on a puzzle, and then all of a sudden I've stopped thinking about it. I'm not even trying to solve the problem any longer. And I look up and I see a green light turn to a red light, and bingo, in a flash, that's the answer. I didn't even know I was thinking about it. And my brain, which never stopped thinking about it, spit out the answer to me. Well, now, this is the critical question. Was that a rational process or a non-rational process? And what Polanyi gives me permission to do is to recognize, well, of course it's a rational process. That's human intelligence at work. Now, we can easily mistake that for a muse as a supernatural process. Oh, the muse spoke to me, or God, the Spirit of God gave me that, or whatever. Now, on the other hand, the Spirit of God uses my rationality. So he may, God may also be speaking to me, but he's speaking to me through an experience that is utterly normal. It's how human intelligence works. I mean, non-believers who don't have the Spirit of God have hunches. It's not nothing supernatural. It's just how the mind works. And hunches are not infallible, notice, because my intelligence has to work with what it's got to work with. If it has a faulty worldview, for example, then it may come up with an answer based on that worldview, but it's a faulty worldview, so it's a false answer. And however powerful the hunch I may experience the hunch as, doesn't make it true. And so that's why it's always valuable, once I get the hunch, to then stop and say, now how did I get there? And we can't always do it, but if we can do it, to kind of slow down now, go through the steps that got me there so that I can evaluate it and judge it. But that can be dangerous too. I read a book called The Gift of Fear. I read parts of a book called The Gift of Fear, and the thesis of the book is we need to learn to trust our hunches, our intuitions. You know, he gave a story of a guy who went into a convenience store, just got this really, really strange feeling that he shouldn't be here and left, just as shooting broke out and people were killed and that kind of stuff. Well, and his point is all too often we're trained to be rational, right? And so we all too often will take our fears, the intuitions of fear that we have, and talk ourselves out of it. Oh, you don't have any reason to be afraid. Basically we become our own skeptic and say, prove it to me. Prove to me that you should be fearful. And he's saying that's a huge mistake, because the reason you're fearful is probably because you've picked up on all kinds of clues and they're telling you something and you've reached a conclusion. Go with it. You'll live longer and be safer if you go with it. That's his thesis.
How is that different from a child who's irrationally afraid that he has a monster under his bed, for example?
Well, in my experience, now that's a great. Actually, I don't know the answer to that question. Probably, in part, yeah.
But hasn't he worked on the skills yet?
Right.
Because rational is the skill set. You build those by practice.
Right.
So the first piece of wood that the violence chose probably wasn't very good. But over time, you learn how to choose the best ones.
Mm-hmm.
You should repeat what the end said.
Oh, yeah. Well, she should repeat. But.
So I was trying to say that the child just doesn't have the practice for the skill set in the same way that the man who was choosing the best violin, because I'm sure that the first man that chose the first violin didn't have that skill quite yet, because it's still, even the skills, they're a matter of practice and rationality. And so over time, the child will know that there's no monsters under his bed. At least that's how I learned that there are no monsters under my bed.
It probably takes some parents coming in and poking their head under the bed and proving to them that it's not there, that they...
Yeah.
What I had in mind was when I was talking about the intuition that a certain place isn't safe.
Oh, yes. I didn't read enough of the book to know if he answers that, but I suspect that it's along the lines of what Deanna is saying, is that he's talking about adults who have over time had their senses trained to pick up clues. Yeah, children are vulnerable in so many ways. I mean, I think when they sense a monster under the bed, there is a very real insecurity that they're feeling. But they haven't learned to know what the source of that insecurity is, and their imagination goes wild and either make things up or know stuff that we don't know.
While even in the case of someone's intuition telling them that they shouldn't be somewhere because it might be dangerous, I'm talking about the adult, the difference would probably be the experience, been.
Right.
Yeah, even though this may be from my limited experience on the matter, but how someone's intuition could tell them that something bad's going to happen somewhere.
So, I'm sorry, ask that again? How could that be?
How could someone's intuition?
Well, his thesis is, and this is completely compatible with Polanyi, is that we are constantly taking in information with our senses that we don't know we're taking in. We're seeing things we don't know we're seeing. We're noticing things we don't know we're noticing. And the mind is putting those together into a picture. And so apparently in this example he was giving, you know, he's realizing the odd behavior of some people in the store, maybe a glint of metal in a belt. And nothing that caught his attention such that it came to consciousness, where he says, well, that means such and such, but it was creating this picture at an unconscious level of this is not looking good. This is not going well. I need to get out of here. And so the only thing that he became conscious of is, I think I need to get out of here. And he couldn't have told you why at that point, because he didn't know what it was that he knew that had led to that intuition.
I think I understand it better.
I mean, so given that the reason and tacit knowledge are both...
Is that all?
Yeah.
Are both valid ways of knowing things. I mean, what do you make of the prophets in the Bible have kind of a beatific vision, not with the same idea of like seeing everything from God's perspective and now here I am, one with the universe, but like... Hey, I'm Ezekiel, and I see this vision, and you know, there's wheels and wheels within wheels, and heads that are going every way. And pretty soon, he starts to sound like a hippie or a sci-fi writer or something. And if you were to ask Ezekiel, well, how do you know there was wheels?
Hippies are so abused.
How do you know there was wheels and wheels inside of wheels and all these faces and it was going every direction at once or whatever the hell he's saying and. How do you know? Well, I saw it. I saw it. God just, you know, uncovered it to me. And I mean, so if we begin with an assumption that says that is a legitimate way of knowing things, that's legitimate for Ezekiel, then we have to also say that the assumption that led people to the beatific vision was in some way correct. Right, that you can have some, that the idea of epistemologically coming to conclusions based on subjective spiritual experiences through whatever means, that is somehow validated.
Well, why would you call them subjective? Why would you call these Ezekiel's visions subjective spiritual experiences?
Because you can't quantify it. It's unquantifiable, unfalsifiable. I can't prove Ezekiel wrong if he tells me that he saw that, and I'm a Jew, and I say, are you sure you saw that? I'm not sure you saw that. I can't prove him wrong if he says you saw that. So that's what makes it subjective.
Well, it may be that we don't know enough, but what I... Is a dream empirical?
I guess when you're having the dream, you could consider it empirical, but once you begin to try to recollect the dream, I think it's befuddled with all sorts of mental fuzziness and...
Okay.
And things. I guess in a way you could call it empirical.
That's how I understand the prophets, mm-hmm. is that they're having enhanced dreams. That what they call a vision is some kind of enhanced dream. Now mm-hmm. I don't know what the mechanism is. I don't know if the mechanism is the same as a dream. I don't think so. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the phenomenology, that is the actual way they experience the phenomenon, I see it as like a dream-like state, only enhanced.
Sure.
Enhanced in two respects, more vivid such that it leaves a more lasting impact on the memory, and coherent rather than fragmented and incoherent. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, it's actually empirical data. Mm-hmm. I mean, they might as well be sitting there watching a part of history and reporting it to me, because they had a actual perceptual experience, or at least a something very like a perceptual experience that they're reporting to me. And I just see that as kind of quasi-empirical data.
I see what you mean by empirical now. Under that definition, I would probably say dreams are subjective.
Okay.
That they, in some sense, objectively exist, but because I'm the only one experiencing them, because
okay.
they're not quantifiable, because no one can prove me wrong if I say that I dreamt X. In that sense, they are subjective.
Okay.
And so then that's what I mean when I say...
Because they were not objectively available to anybody else but me. That's what you mean.
Yeah, it's totally okay. personal, totally subjective.
Right. Well, that's why. But see, that's why in the covenant, Moses reveals to Israel, if a prophet comes along and says X is going to happen and it doesn't happen, stone him to death. He's a false prophet. Mm-hmm. So the subjective revelation may not be verifiable, mm-hmm. but if they make a prediction, it's verifiable. Because if it doesn't come about, or if it's not verifiable, then what good is the prediction, and what good is the prophecy? Mm-hmm. So God recognizes the problem there. If I'm ever going to use my prophets to speak and do so by giving them a subjective revelation out of which to speak, I'm going to have to make it possible for other people to know that he really is a prophet who really is speaking for me, that he's not fraudulent, he's not lying, he's not mm-hmm. deceived, he really is a prophet.
Yep.
So yeah, the subjective nature of revelation in that regard is problematic.
Yeah, interestingly, in that text, it goes on to say that if he prophesies something and it does happen, and then he says, let's go worship other gods.
Stone him.
Well, you stone him anyways. Yeah. Who cares if he's a prophet?
No, exactly.
I mean, so I think we're on the same page there. So isn't that the foundation for the beatific vision? I mean, they could just say, it's an enhanced dream. God showed me this.
If all they were saying is, one day we're going to have a subjective dream-like experience of such and such a nature, then no, I don't have any logical problem with that. I don't know where they're getting that from
sure.
the Bible,
yep.
but I don't have any logical problem with that. What I'm arguing is, what they argue is that the beatific vision is the ultimate fulfillment of your humanity.
Okay.
Where are they getting that? Straight out of Plato.
Yeah.
Because that's, for Platonism, that's the ultimate fulfillment of human existence.
I see.
So that's the part I'm objecting to, mm-hmm. not sure. I mean, Paul had where he was caught up into the third heaven. Whether it was in the body or not, I do not know. Mm-hmm. You know? So he had some kind of strange, subjective, presumably,
yeah.
Dreamlike experience, some of which he couldn't articulate. He said, I don't have any problem with that. That's fine. If God wants to do that, he can do that. But Paul never comes back and says, wow, dude, you ought to have that experience. I mean, that was the ultimate, you know.
But someone recently,
he doesn't push it on us as the height and apex of spirituality.
Someone recently told me they thought that Paul was high on moldy bread when he had that experience. And he didn't know it. So.
Okay. So I think we've done everything down through to B is theory of forms. So that's probably a good place to stop since we're at the end of time. So next week we'll talk about his theory of forms. Oh, okay. Okay. The allegory of the cave is, I'll just end with that, is in the Republic, his dialogue called The Republic. He tells this story about, there's a man who, this will make more sense after I get the theory of forms. Remind me to tell you the allegory of the cave after we've talked about his theory of forms. So we'll do that next week.